answers.
Thanks, Thomas, and thanks the organizers of the conference and of the our session for inviting me and you for coming. So this article that I will talk about can be found also in my webpage. You can download it from there. So let's start by mentioning the famous Lomonosov theorem that says that if you have a complex Banach space and a compact operator not zero, K, and another operator T, which is not a multiple of the identity, and commutes with K, then T has a non-trivial hyperinvariant subspace. And what does non-trivial... I want to say that I prepare my audience for to be accessible to the students, so I define everything, and I apologize for if it's boring sometimes. what does non-trivial hyperinvariant subspace? Subspace means always closed linear submanifold. Non-trivial means that this Y is sits strictly between 0 and X. Of course, 0 and X would be invariant, but strictly between them. And hyperinvariant means that for every operator S in the commutant of T, which will be denoted like that, we have S of Y subset of Y. So it's the Y is invariant. The same Y is invariant under every S in the commutant of T. Of course, this theorem generalized the result of Arosan and Smith that compact operators in general Banach spaces have non-trivial invariant subspaces. Of course, if you think of a compact operator, the spectrum of a compact operator is a sequence of eigenvalues which converges to zero, and zero might also be in the spectrum, and this sequence might or might not exist. So if you have eigenvalues, then you are done. So the only difficult case for compact operators is if you have a compact operator whose spectrum is only zero. Such operators are called nilpotent, and zero is not an eigenvalue. So for those operators, Arosan and Smith said that they have invariant, non-trivial invariant subspaces. So the proof of Lomonosov uses Schauder's fixed point theorem, which says that if you have a closed bounded convex set in some norm space, and you have a map from the set, let's call the set A, to the space X, and you know that the map is compact, which means that the image, the closure of the image is compact. Yeah. If it preserves that set A, if f of A is subset of A, then it must have a fixed point. Of course, you cannot put your hands into the theorem and see how exactly this fixed point is picked, and based on that fixed point of that map, this hyperinvariant subspace is picked. So it's an existence theorem, but it doesn't. I don't know, philosophically speaking, it doesn't give you a lot of information to put your hands into the subspace and see how it's constructed. Of course, the motivation for the theorem is the invariant subspace problem for Hilbert space. For instance, does every operator in L2 have a Hilbert space? Or this problem, which at least sounds easier, and probably it's easier, really. So does there exist an infinite dimensional Banach space so that in that good space, all the operators have non-trivial invariant subspaces. And the reason I say does there exist is because everybody knows the counterexamples given in the 70s by Yenflow or 80s by Reed, that bad Banach spaces can be actually L1 exist, and bad operators there with no non-trivial invariant subspaces. So, 4 years ago, Ansari and Enflow proved a special case of Lomonosov's theorem. They work on Hilbert space, L2. And they start with a compact operator, and they use a different method than Lomonosov to prove that, and Arozan and Smith, actually they prove something more than that, Arozan and Smith. They use a different method than Lomonosov to prove that K has a non-trivial hyperinvariant subspace. The proof uses the method of what is called minimal vectors, and what I present here, so that's where the title of my talk comes from, and they are the people who name the method. So actually their method, philosophically speaking, it looked to me in many places similar to the method of Arozan and Smith, and somehow gives you more, it's a constructive method again, but it gives you more understanding where are these hyperinvariant subspaces. And Carl Peercy strengthened the method to prove that if you have again on Hilbert space L2, if you have a compact non-zero operator, and now you have a quasi-nilpotent operator Q, non-zero, which commutes with K. So it's not a multiple of the identity because it's quasi-nilpotent. So it commutes with K, then Q has a non-trivial hyperinvariant subspace. So, and strengthen the method. What I want to present, the main theorem I want to present is basically, I'm interested more in the problem that I call invariant subspace problem for Banach spaces, which sounds easier. So I want to work in general Banach spaces rather than on the Hilbert space L2. And I wanted to get rid of this assumption that there is a compact operator in the commutant in order to get hyperinvariant subspaces. Actually, I'd be happy with the invariant too. But so I want to get rid of that assumption. So here's the theorem. I work in a super reflexive Banach space. I consider a quasi-nilpotent operator, not zero. I call it Q, so I remember it's quasi-nilpotent. I assume that it satisfies a property star that I will define in the moment, which is formally, weaker than having a compact operator in the commutant of Q. And the conclusion is that then Q has a non-trivial hyperinvariant subspace. So the difference from the previous theorem is that I have here a super reflexive Banach space, and the assumption is formally weaker. This satisfies this property star. So what is that property star? I have a Banach space, and I have an operator acting on the Banach space, Q. I say it satisfies property star if for every epsilon, in 0, 1, epsilon will be in 0, 1 always, there exists a vector x naught in the space of norm 1 such that, so this is the picture, for every epsilon, there is this vector x naught of norm 1, so that if you consider the sphere with center x naught and radius epsilon, and you take xn to be any weakly convergent sequence in x which is on that sphere, so this is xn, I don't know, x2, x3, xn lives here on the sphere and converges weakly to some vector. By the way, if it lives on that sphere and converges weakly to some vector, the vector is not going to be zero. Then the limb is not going to be zero. Then I assume that the commutant of Q is a little bit big, but I don't assume that it contains a compact. What I assume is that I can go to a subsequence of Xn, which I call Xnk, and there exists the sequence K sub K. There exists a sequence of operators in the commutant of Q, not necessarily compact operators, bounded sequence, so that if you apply the kth, so there exists the sequence KK in the commutant of Q, so that if you apply the K operator to the K vector, then this converges in norm to a non-zero vector. This converges in norm to some vector which is not zero. Okay, so this is the property, that if you give me the epsilon, I can provide you the x0. So that in this ball, I can play this game here. So the remark is, as I said, that this property is formally weaker than having a compact operator k in the commutant. And the reason is because you can choose, if you know that you have an operator, if you have an operator q and the compact k in the commutant, then how do you choose this k sub k to satisfy property star? You choose them all to be equal to this operator k in the commutant. Okay, so this is why. Indeed, take some non-zero operator in the commutant. Let me show you the proof of the remark, which is trivial. Assume that is normalized. You give me the epsilon positive. How do I pick the x-naught? Well, I pick the x-naught so that the operator is almost normed there. K of x-naught is bigger than 1 plus epsilon over 2. Epsilon is bigger, smaller than 1, so this number is less than 1. Now, you give me any weakly convergent sequence in the sphere. And since the operator is compact, it's going to converge. If you apply the operator there, it's going to converge in norm. Now, I have to show you that the limit is not 0. And this is trivial, really, because of the triangle inequality, because I have taken the operator K almost achieves its norm at the center of the ball. So if you do the triangle inequality, K of xn minus K of xn is bigger than K of x0 minus K of xn minus x0. The first term is 1 plus epsilon, and this you can say is smaller than K. Norm of k times the norm of xn minus x0. Norm of k is 1. This is epsilon, and you subtract and you get something positive, so the limit is not 0. Now, if you look at this proof, you can see that, well, I could have defined the property star slightly different, stronger probably, but I can say that an operator q satisfies the property star if for every epsilon I can find the next naught of norm 1. Epsilon is always between 0 and 1. I can find the next naught of norm 1 such that whenever I take a weakly convergent sequence on the sphere of center x naught and radius epsilon, there is a subsequence and there is a sequence of operators in the commutant, so that if you apply the kth operator to the kth element of the sequence, it converges in norm. This sequence converges in norm. And instead of assuming that it's non-zero, I could assume that all of these operators almost achieve their norm in the center. And then the same proof that I just showed you, it shows that then if that happens, then the limit cannot be zero just by the triangle inequality from below. So this is the property star. Basically, instead of it's formally, I don't know if it's really stronger, but instead of saying, so this sequence of operators depends on the weakly convergent sequence you give me. And they don't have to be compact. The only thing that I require is that if you apply the kth operator to the kth vector, it converges in norm. So that's how big I assume that is the commutant of Q. So, okay, I told you about this method of minimal vectors, but I didn't define them yet, so let's define them. What are the minimal vectors? I'll give you the definition now. I can define the minimal vectors in every reflexive Banach space. So this is something that somehow differs by the previous known methods of extracting invariant or hyperinvariant subspaces. The methods almost work in every Banach space. This method, but there are counterexamples of the invariant subspace problem in non-reflexive Banach spaces. And this method somehow seems that it really uses the reflexivity, and I don't see how it can be avoided. I don't know how it can be avoided in the method. So start with the reflexive Banach space and start with an operator on X with dense range. But when we examine the invariant subspace problem, we can always assume the operator has dense range because the range is hyper, the closure of the range is hyperinvariant. So assume it's dense. Take an epsilon in 0, 1 and take a fixed vector x naught in x of norm 1. I'm going to define a sequence of vectors yn, which is called sequence of minimal vectors of q with respect to epsilon and x naught. It's not unique. It's not the sequence of minimal vectors. It's a sequence of minimal vectors. It's a sequence of minimal vectors. So for every n, okay, this is the definition. Let me try to explain it. For every n, okay, so I have this x naught and I have this epsilon. X naught is of norm 1 and epsilon is a number between 0 and 1. And then I take the operator q to the n, okay? And I take the inverse image of this ball, the inverse image of this ball through the operator q to the n. So it's going to be some set up there further away. So this is q to the n inverse image of this ball. And I pick a vector here, which will be the nth vector of the sequence yn. N is fixed in this procedure. I pick a vector here, yn, in the inverse image that has the smallest norm among all of these vectors. And such a vector yn exists if... Sorry. The smallest small. So the norm of yn is the infimum of all the norms y here. For every y here. For every y here. And why does yn exist if we are in the situation of reflexivity with dense range? Okay. Look at this set, inverse image of the ball. What kind of set is that? This is non-empty. Why? Because q has dense range, so q to the n has dense range. So inverse image of a ball will be non-empty. It's closed because the ball is closed, and it's convex because the ball is convex. So I can pick a sequence. I can pick a sequence yn1, n is fixed. Yn1, yn2, yn3, etc. I can pick a sequence in that set which goes, the norm goes down to the infimum of that of all the vectors in that set. Now, so I can restrict myself into the intersection of the inverse image of the ball with a bounded set. Okay, I can restrict myself all the vectors in the inverse image of the ball which have norm less than yn1, the norm of yn1. So now, if you take the intersection, of the inverse image of the ball together with all the vectors that have norm at most yn1, then this intersection has all the previous properties, plus it's bounded in a reflexive space, so it's weakly compact. So I can find a subsequence that converges to some vector, let's call it yn, and that's the vector I'm looking for. That's the vector that, by passing the subsequence and relabeling, assume that this yn1, yn2, as it goes down, converges weakly to some vector. Right? And that vector, the weak limit, is going to belong to the set, this weakly compact set. And it's going to belong in particular to the inverse image of the ball. And since the norm is weakly lower semi-continuous, the norm only decreases, but it belongs, the norm of yn is smaller than the infimum of all of the norms of y, but the yn still is in the inverse image of the ball, so it's equal to the infimum. Right? So I can find such a sequence, yn. And again, I apologize. So the next page has to do with, so since I use super reflexivity, the next page has to do with some notions about superreflexivity, so the space, I'll go through quickly, is smooth if for every x there is a unique functional that norms the x. There is a unique functional. Always there is at least one, but if it's unique, then it's smooth. And I norm the functional left sub x to have the same norm as the normal function. You can norm it to have norm 1. It doesn't matter how you norm it. I just thought in Hilbert space, the f sub x and the x is equal. F sub x is equal to x. And this is equivalent to something that was mentioned here before, that is that the norm is Gatow differentiable. So this limit exists, but this limit is always a real number, so it cannot be anything but this, what I write here, the real part of the norm 1 norming function will apply to y, this is linear. And the space is uniformly smooth if this limit exists uniformly for all x's and y's in the sphere. And uniform convex means that if whenever you have two points on the sphere that are epsilon apart, the average has norm smaller than 1 minus delta, where the delta only depends on epsilon and doesn't depend on x and y. If the x and the y are epsilon apart, then the average has norm smaller than 1 minus delta. And there is a characterization of super reflexive means that every other space that is finitely represented in X is reflexive. And there is a characterization of super reflexivity followed by a theorem of Enflot. And you can use the theorem of Asplund, a little bit earlier theorem of Asplund, to prove that. That super reflexivity is equivalent to be equivalent, so that the space can be equivalently renormed to be smooth or uniformly smooth or uniformly convex or both. What I'm going to use here throughout, I'm going to assume that the space is this is uniformly convex. So I'm going to use this delta function. I wrote it intentionally as a function because it's a function of uniform convexity. So I'm going to use this delta function. And I will recall from time to time that the space is smooth, so I can have this unique functional f sub x. Okay, so here's the proof of the main theorem. So we start with, a nice space, super reflexive, so smooth and uniformly convex, as I said. We start with an operator which is quasi-nilpotent. Without loss of generality, I can assume that it has dense range is 1 to 1. Otherwise, as I said, the closure of the range and the kernel are hyperinvariant. I assume that it satisfies property start. Now I have to find for you a hyperinvariant subspace for Q. That's what I have to find for you. Okay, so I'm going to use the following fact, and I will come back at the end and show you the proof of the fact. Based on this, so the space is uniformly convex. So based on the uniform convexity function, modulus of uniform convexity delta function, there is this epsilon, there is a number epsilon, which is rather large. Usually we think of epsilon being close to zero, but this is close to one, really. There is a number epsilon which is between 1/2 and 1, so that for every x naught of norm 1, if we take the sequence of minimal vectors with respect to epsilon and x naught, and we take f to be a weak star limit point of the norming functional of this, so I better explain what are these things, then the weak star limit point is not zero. So there exists this epsilon, so that if you... Actually, I could have used the picture I just had here. So that there exists this epsilon, it says, there exists the epsilon, so that no matter where you choose the x naught in the space x of norm 1, this epsilon is rather large, close to 1 actually, depending on the modulus of convexity. And if you take these vectors yn's, which are the inverse image, the smallest vector in the inverse image of the ball, and you take... Okay, so you take the yn and you take q to the n of yn. Q to the n of yn will be down here, right? If you apply q to the n to this set, you get back to the ball. So q to the n of yn will be down here. and you subtract x naught. So you get q to the n of yn minus x naught. And you take the norming function of that. You take this vector here. You take the norming functional f, and you take a weak star limit point of those norming functionals. This will be non-zero. Let me tell you a little bit about that fact, and I will come at the end and prove it again. It's a fact that if you take if you define the sequence of minimal vectors, it has the following property. If you take the yn, the minimal vectors, and you apply qn to yn, you come here, you always come to the sphere. You never go inside, because if the qn of yn will be inside the ball, then you can retract it by a multiple, and you get a vector of smaller norm, so you can retract the pre-image, you get something with smaller norm, and this is the smallest norm that you can find in the pre-image. So the qn of yn is always on the sphere. Another property is that qn of yn is always on the sunny side of the sphere, if the sun is positioned at the point zero. There is a way to write down that thing algebraically, of course. And, you can write that. That means that if the sun is at the point zero, is on the sunny side of the sphere. You cannot find it up here, because then you could instead take this point, and then the pre-image will have a smaller norm. So you have this sequence qn of yn, and you subtract the x naught, take the norming functions of that, and the weak star limit point f, which I'm going to fix now, this is non-empty, non-zero, sorry. So pick such an epsilon by this fact 1. Now recall what property star tells you. Property star tells you, now that the epsilon has been fixed, no matter where the... tells you that there is an x naught, sorry. If now that the epsilon is fixed, it says that for every epsilon, there is an x naught. I just copy-paste here the property star. There is an x naught of norm 1, so that for every weakly null sequence on the surface of the sphere, for every such weakly convergent sequence, sorry, there is a sequence of operators in the commutant bounded so that if you apply the kth operator to the kth element, converges in norm to a non-zero vector. Well, since the property star gives us this x naught, let's pick it up, and let's make the sphere, and let's make the inverse, take the yn's. So take the sequence of minimal vectors. If I want to have the whole proof on the board, probably I should use it now, at this moment, the second projector as well. So, probably I can stop it. You see the picture. So, fact two. So, grant me another fact here, and I'll come at the end and prove it. So, if I have the sequence of minimal vectors, then there is a subsequence of the subsequence nk. So that if you take consecutive terms, not consecutive in the subsequence, but real consecutive, yn k minus 1, see the minus 1 is up, real, honest, subsequent terms, then they become bigger and bigger. If yn k is here, then yn k plus 1 is much larger. Sorry, I call this yn k minus 1. Ynk is much larger vector. This is the Ynk, this vector here, minus 1. And this vector here, take the inverse image through the Qnk, this is the inverse image, nk minus 1. And this will be the inverse image through Qnk of the same ball. And this is much larger vector than this. All right? Well, fix that sequence too that is granted by fact 2. I'm going to play the whole game between these two there are two sequences, the nk sequence and the nk minus 1 sequence. I'm going to play the whole game with those two. Apply qnk minus 1 to ynk minus 1, so you bring it back here. So this is Q and K minus 1 y and k minus 1, and then subtract x naught. So this is this vector here. And assume by passing to a subsequence that this sequence of vectors, which are norm epsilon, converges weakly. Okay, now I apply property star. Property star tells me that there exists a sequence of operators in the commutant, so that if you apply the sequence of operators to this, to Q and K minus 1 of Y and K minus 1, if you apply the sequence of operators, it converges to norm, to something non-zero. I have for you to tell you what is the hyperinvariant subspace. As always, so these theorems, if you look at Lomonosov's papers, always is the image through the commutant, any operator of the commutant of a certain vector. I only have to tell you which vector. So this is the vector. Take W, take Q of W, and that's the image through the every operator in the commutant of that vector. So say take image through every operator, this is going to be hyperinvariant. The only thing I have to show you that this is non-trivial, as in all of these proofs. Non-trivial means not zero nor the whole space. Well, the W I chose is not zero. Q is 1 to 1, so Q of W is not going to be 0. The only thing I have to show for you is that it's not the whole space. Yes. Sorry. The whole space. How am I going to show this? Here's the how. I'm gonna take a point. I know, you see, by F, Q and K minus 1, Y and K minus 1, minus x naught. I have these functionals, and I have a weak star limit point of those. F from fact 1, if you remember, that is not 0. And I'm going to show that this y is subset. This is not 0. I'm going to show that this y is subset of the kernel of that functional, and since f is not 0, y is not the whole space. So I have to show for you that for every t in the commutant, if you apply f to t of q of w, you get 0. And this is done in the last page. Okay, every vector can be written as a multiple of y and k plus something in the kernel of the corresponding functional, because this is codimension on space, the kernel. So this is the only tricky part. Take this vector, this t, k sub k, y and k minus 1. This is the only tricky part, how one thinks to get to think of that vector. Take that vector and write it in terms as a multiple of y and k plus something else in the kernel of the corresponding functional. Now, remember that these two, y and k and y and k minus 1, are very different in norm. So I apply to y and k minus 1 some bounded operators, and then I write it in terms of y and k, so you expect that the coefficient ak is going to be small. It's going to go to 0. This is a trivial proof. Right? If you write the because you can find the norm of ak, y, and k by applying the functional to the corresponding functional to ak, y, and k plus rk. And then you can use this form to substitute ak, y, and k plus rk by t, k sub k, y, and k minus 1. And then, how do you call this? Holder's inequality? Whatever. And you cancel this with a square, and you divide by the y and k minus 1, and by the y and k, and it goes to 0 by fact 2, which was saying that the quotient goes to infinity. Okay, so first of all, we start with equation 2. And then to equation 2, apply first Q and K, and then these dual functionals, these functionals, Q and K of Y and K minus X naught, the norming functional of that. So apply to all three terms here. I have an equation here. I apply to all three terms, linearity. And then I remember that the AK goes to 0. And then I claim that the third term is equal to 0. The reason that it's equal to 0 is just granted for the moment from fact 3, which is the last fact. because the RK is in the kernel of FNK, the RK is in the kernel of FNK, and then the kernel of FNK is a subset of the kernel of this composition here. So the last term is equal to zero, and this goes to zero, so the left-hand side goes to zero. Now I remember that the Q, that the T and the K sub K both came from the commutant of Q. So I can play games now. I want the Y and K minus 1 to be together with the Q and K minus 1, and I'm free to move NK minus 1 of the Qs next to the Y and K here on the left-hand side. I except one of them, I move all the rest there, and one of them I move just one position next to the T, right? So I know that this goes to zero. Now, remember how we defined W? It's on the other slide. W is the norm limit of this part. Norm limit and weak star limit here is F, and that's what exactly we wanted to show. So the commutant applied to QW belongs to the is a subset of the kernel of F. Now I have to come back and prove for you the facts that I used. Right? Fact one, whatever it says, I start with a remark that we have already seen. It doesn't say anything. This remark says that if you have the sequence of minimal vectors, they always live on the sphere. They always live on the sphere, and they live on the sunny side of the sphere. This means sunny side of the sphere. Remark two, it says, that's the main part, that if you have a uniformly convex Banach space, then I can choose an epsilon large enough so that for every x naught, if I choose an epsilon large enough, so here is zero, here is x naught, there is an epsilon large enough so that for every x naught of norm 1, if I take a W on the sunny side of that sphere, W is on the sphere with center x naught and radius epsilon, if the epsilon is large enough, and is on the sunny side, is not on the other side, then the W has small norm. The reason is, as you blow up this sphere, you cannot have W of large norm because the sphere doesn't have any flat segments there. It's uniformly convex. Uniformly convexity doesn't allow flat segments there. So W has to have small norm as you blow up the sphere. That's why W is going to have... And that's exactly the epsilon that fact one says, that there is an epsilon, so that if you do the method of minimal, you apply the method of, you find the minimal vectors with respect to this ball, then the weak star limit point of these functionals is going to be non-zero. The reason is, okay, you have those functionals, Qn of Yn minus X naught, and because these functionals, these vectors have very small norm, the Qn, these vectors here are the Qn of Yn. Because they have very small norm, if you subtract the x naught, it's almost like minus x naught. So you take the norming functional, it's like the norming functional of minus x naught. So you apply it to minus x naught, and you're going to get something large, of course. And two more facts. Second fact says that there is a sequence nk so that the quotients go to infinity. We use that very much. And... Well, if not, then the sequence is bounded by some C. So start from an N and apply it many times. Yn plus 1 is smaller than Cyn, C squared, Yn minus 1, etc., until you go to 1. C to the N, Y1. Now, the Y1 has the property that if you apply Q1 to it, right, we are in this picture for N equals 1, NK equals 1. The Y1 has the property that if you apply Q1 to it, you go into that ball with center x naught and radius epsilon. Actually, go to the sphere, but all right. You go to the ball. And here's another vector. This vector Qn of Yn plus 1 is another vector that if you apply Q1 to it, you go to the ball. Because 1 plus n is 1 plus n. Yeah. So this vector here has to have smaller norm than the norm of Y1. Because Y1 was... This is where the minimality is used. Y1 is the smallest norm.
Actually, it's used in more places than this place, but this one place where the minimality is used. I will point out where else. Y1 has smaller norm. Okay, so I can substitute equation 5 to equation 4. I can put the Y1 back there. And I can split Qn of Yn plus 1 as norm of Qn, norm of Yn plus 1. I can cancel this, which is not easily seen, that is not 0. And I get this inequality. That means that Q is not quasi-nilpotent contradiction, because Q was quasi-nilpotent. So, and the third fact, okay, so that proves the second fact. This proves that the sequence Nk that I said exists. The third fact, I said by picture, okay, so the third fact says, let's erase, I have too many indices here. So let's say that we construct the nth vector of the minimal sequence. So we construct the nth vector yn of the minimal sequence. And the third fact says that, what does it say? It says that the kernel, that was written, it says, this is what was saying the third fact, kernel of Fyn is subset of the kernel of F Qn Yn minus X naught composition with Q to the N. Okay, this was the third fact. Why is that true? Okay, this is the vector Yn. Okay, something in the kernel of the norming functional will probably look something like this. This is the vector R in the kernel of the norming functional. Now, if I apply the operator Q to the n to the vector R, I apply the operator Q to the n to the vector R. Yn, if you apply the operator Q to the n to Yn, you come here. So this is, this vector here is Q to the n Yn minus X naught. If you move perpendicular to the pre-image, then you apply the operator Q to the n to here, and you will move perpendicular to the kernel. You're going to move perpendicular to the ball. If you move perpendicular to the pre-image, here it moves perpendicular to the ball. This is a consequence of the smoothness and the minimality of the vector of the norm of Yn. It's not difficult to prove it. It's just easier to explain. I mean, the picture shows that if you move perpendicular to the image, pre-image, then the image moves perpendicular to the sphere. Well, here I didn't write anything. But, yeah, would be more probably more convincing. I don't know, the algebra. And I finish with two open problems. One asks, do there exist quasi-nilpotent operators that satisfy property star but do not have any non-zero compact operator in their commutant? If the answer is yes, then there are some operators that you can apply this method, but you could not apply the Lomonosov method. And the second question is, okay, as I said, the second question is my real question. My real motivation is I want to see if there exists a Banach space, the invariant subspace problem for Banach spaces. So, does every operator with non-trivial invariant subspace satisfy property star? Why do I ask this question? If you see the proofs of Lomonosov or other people that prove invariant existence of invariant subspaces, they always start with an algebra, right, that has non-trivial invariant subspace, and they prove that this algebra is large in some sense, like Bernstein's theorem. It's large in some sense, yeah? And that's how. And then they apply this result to the algebra of either the algebra generated by a single operator or the commutator of an operator, and they get either invariant subspaces or hyperinvariant subspaces in each case. But anyhow, if the question to this, if say you can combine this method with the existing methods, and you answer affirmatively this question, then take any quasi-nilpotent operator in a super-reflexive Banach space. If it has invariant subspace, you're very lucky. If it doesn't have any invariant subspace, then since you know that the answer to this question is yes, then it must satisfy property star, then you can use this method to find an invariant subspace. So it's a contradiction. If it doesn't have an invariant subspace and the answer to question two is yes, then you can use this method to find one. It's a contradiction. So it must have an invariant subspace. In particular, now, quasi-nilpotent is not a big problem for me because there are, and super-reflexivity either, because there are super-reflexive, what is called HI Banach spaces, and in such spaces all the operators are multiple of the identity plus strictly singular, and they are all, the strictly singular and the compact have the same kind of spectrum, so you can assume that the operator is always quasi-nilpotent because otherwise it has eigenvectors. So then you will be done. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions, comments?
Did you put up star again?
Yeah. For every epsilon, there exists an X naught of norm 1. For every weakly convergent sequence in X in the sphere of center X naught and radius epsilon, I can find the subsequence and the sequence of operators in the commutant, not necessarily compact, uniformly bounded, so that the image converges in norm to a non-zero vector. Actually, this method can be a little bit improved, actually.
Yeah.
The last question. Right.
Does every operator with non-trivial invariant subspace satisfy property star?
Does every operator?
Does every operator with... So Lomonosov, for instance...
An operator is
Lomonosov proved his theorem for operators commuting with Hofmann operators. The question is whether property star follows the existence of a non-trivial compact operator.
No, it's the first question. The second question is that the transitive
operator... Right. Transitive operators have properties. Yeah, that's the question. That's correct.
Do you know that this is true for the top operator? Why is it a funny?
Well, okay, it can be checked, for instance.
Why should you expect
There is this Lomonosov's lemma that says transitive operators can somehow undo what a compact operator is doing. For every compact, if you have a transitive algebra, and you have, if you have an algebra with non-trivial invariant subspace, and you have any compact operator, there is an operator in the algebra that if you multiply them together has one as an eigenvalue. So from that spirit, is somehow it's big. The algebra must be big, must be large. So is it that large that I can find those operators that I can send x and k if you apply k to a norm to a non-zero vector?
And you say that you didn't check it for you don't know.
So the operators, the operators to check, the appropriate operators to check are the RIS operators, right? I mean, we have some examples of operators. There is a RIS operator which is quasi-nilpotent. For example...
You ask it for arbitrary transitive operators.
Right. But you can check it for some certain operators, or
Or you can prove it in general. I don't know. I haven't checked it.
Okay, why don't we continue this later? Let's take the speaker again.